It is Saturday, September 6th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and a discussion with author James Glave about going green.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on Geek Speak, we have author James Glave. His book is called Going Green, Almost Green, and it's all about his efforts to go green in our society. He lives up in Canada on a small island. He's built a shed that's all green, and the book kind of explores the humor behind his experience. In any case, we'll have him on air in about 20 minutes. But we are going to be taking your calls during the second half with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now to send us messages. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the room with me are geeks John Tracy. Good morning, John.
Morning.
And Miles Elam. Hi, Miles.
Good morning.
How you guys doing today?
Doing good. Quite well.
Yeah, we got a lot of geek news today. I think I'll start with you, Miles.
Electronic Arts' new game called Spore.
Looks I love it and play it all the time.
Will be released very soon.
Dope!
The creature creator came out a while ago, but now the actual game will be released.
Yeah, and I'm not that special. I don't actually have the game. I've been playing with the creature creator, and I think I mentioned it on air before. It's this amazing 3D creature creating software, and it's free. Pretty neat. Right. Go on.
But a wrinkle to all of this is if you're on the Mac, you can play the game. You can buy the game and play it, but only if you have a Intel chip Mac.
A
newer Macintosh. And if you are running Leopard, the very newest version of the Mac operating system. So if you have Panther or Tiger, it won't work.
I understand the issue of using an Intel chip. It's got a lot better performance, but why not make it compatible with Tiger? I mean, Leopard and Tiger aren't that different.
That's a fine question and an answer I do not know. So basically, this is something that came out a while ago, but I caught this on a CNET article because they were mentioning that no one's really talking about this. Even though there are a large number of people who are still on Tiger who have Intel laptops, that to play this game, you'd have to pay the $100 tax to get Leopard and install that and upgrade.
$100 tax.
Well, it's what it is.
What's so special about this game?
The game is, well, it depends on how you look at it. Some people look at it as this is evolution in action, being able to track a creature from the single cell world to all the way up to a spacefaring, you know, terraforming.
Let's give a brief synopsis. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas there are others that might say it's intelligent design because you're the intelligent designer deciding, well, I want this one to have a beak and I want this one, the legs to be a little bit longer.
But your design is based upon the environment. You're influenced by the environment you're around. You choose a better equipment. Basically, you start with a single cell organism. You can build it up with you basically eat and you get points or energy and you use that to buy better tools so that it can move faster, eat better, whatever. And it slowly evolves and from a single cell organism and a multi cell organism to a sea going creature and then eventually evolves to a land based creature. And then you continue
and then
to evolve
brain,
it.
Get brain points.
You keep buying brain points and then eventually you can evolve to a sentient creature. And then from that point, the game becomes more of a
civilization.
Sim City, right. You've got a village and you're interacting with other villages, which, by the way, were designed by other people. Well, initially, no. But I guess there's a large enough database now of other people who have been doing it and other creatures that have been created that what it does is it goes out and it downloads other people's creatures and other people's how they have evolved. So you're basically playing against other evolved creatures that have gone through the whole process.
We had the statistic a couple of months ago about how they've reached a threshold where there are more distinct spore characters than there are distinct species of animal on the planet Earth.
Right, I remember covering that in GeekSpeak. Okay, so the game's exciting. It's coming out tomorrow, but if you've got Tiger or if you've got a PowerPC chip, you can't play it.
It's also, I tried to download the Creature Creator for my MacBook. Well, I've got a 2 gigahertz MacBook with an Intel processor running Tiger, and it is not that great. So, something faster.
All right, next news story. John, please.
Tomorrow, I'm sorry, coming up, Rosetta, European Space Agency's comet viewer that they launched in 2004, is going to be passing the asteroid Steens.
What's Steens?
It's a smallish asteroid out there that's kind of interesting because it's brighter than it should be. We don't understand the density of it, so it's going to take some pictures and do some measurements of the asteroid. This is just while it's on the way to the comet that it's eventually going to rendezvous with in 2014. But they're looking at it to try and get some information about how it's made. Asteroids are important because they contain a lot of, we theorize, they contain a lot of the primordial matter that was created, that was around when the solar system was created.
In fact, most astrophysicists theorize that when the sun ignited, it actually blew pretty much all the lighter materials off the inner planets. That's why we don't have so much gas. And then all the water and oxygen, all the H2O and all the light materials actually came from asteroids slowly over time and built it up. It's pretty impressive.
There's a huge cloud of these around the Oort cloud. It's outside the realm of the planet formerly known as Pluto.
So specifically what they're studying is an asteroid or a comet?
Well, they're flying by an asteroid now on the way to study a comet.
All right.
Yeah, so in 2014 they'll be going around the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko. I'm not pronouncing that
well
correctly.
Said.
It's a yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, John. Miles, next news story, sir.
The new web browser by Google called Chrome has been dominating a lot of the geek news. A huge number of stories about it, a huge amount of buzz. Was even covered by NPR, but still wanted to take the geek viewpoint on it. Which is, one, what is Chrome? Chrome is using the same renderer that Safari is, also known as WebKit, which also has a lot of things in common with the web browser Conker, which is available for Linux in the KDE environment. So that's not going to be a big issue with regard to compatibility. That's one thing that I've heard people talk about is, I got another browser I need to work on and test. Well, it's actually the same rendering engine as in a couple of other browsers, so it probably won't be a big deal that way. What sets Chrome apart is that it actually opens up each web page in a separate process. A separate process meaning if you were to open up Word and then you open up Excel, those are two separate processes. If Excel crashes, it doesn't affect Word at all.
Right, and if one starts taking up all this processor time and starts kind of spinning and not doing anything, the other one's still okay.
Right. Because the operating system kind of keep them, or a good operating system can keep them separated. That was what the main design goal for Chrome was: is keeping those tabs, keeping those web pages separate. And another side effect of that, which is good for security, is the fact that if they are separate processes, having web pages communicate or look at one another. Like for example, let's say you go to your banking website. And you're doing some online banking, transferring funds, paying bills. And then you open up another tab and you go to some gaming site or the like. That gaming site, if say it's taken over by someone malicious or run by someone malicious, can't look at that other page because there is now a process, for lack of a better term, a firewall in between them, a process boundary. That doesn't allow communication. It isn't just a matter of a browser saying, okay, you can't talk to me, or trying to put in, you know, through code a sandbox.
Yeah, okay, so I get that idea, that separation, but why is that such an important thing for a browser? I mean, browsers are just for looking at web pages, right?
They're also used for development. They're also used by developers to find out how much processing time is my page taking, how fast is it running, how...
Okay, and I was kind of leading you up for this, but... Basically, a lot of people are making applications that are a lot more intelligent that are in the web browser. The iPhone's a good example that a lot of the things you see on iPhone are actually just web pages. And then Google has a whole suite of applications that are comparable to Word and Excel that are actually built into the browser. So having a space, having an app that runs it in a separate space means that they actually are running something comparable to Word or Microsoft Excel inside a browser tab, and they act like applications. And some have claimed that this is the future of what the browser will look like. I had heard, Miles, and maybe you can collaborate this with me, that Google...
Corroborate? Sorry.
Yeah. You can collaborate our knowledge in a cooperation. that Google actually put forward a group of people to work on this project a year or two ago or more to think about the future of web browsing and what it would be like. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating that they grabbed, as an example, the WebKit, which Apple's been developing, and you've been developing on the WebKit too, right?
Right. WebKit is so well made that there's no point in trying to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, here's this code that is open source. It's available for anyone to tinker with, and it renders extremely well and is going at a very fast pace. To try to compete with that and try to go through all of the pain again to make your own web browser just seems like a waste of effort.
Right.
And Google did as well. Apple did as well. They're the ones who are the main maintainers of WebKit, but they base it upon a rendering engine called KHTML, which came from the Conqueror project.
Right.
And they were thinking the exact same thing. Let's take this existing base of code and then just build upon it.
Okay. Let's go on to one more news story. I really want to get to James Glave, but I also want to hear about what's happening on Wednesday. John, what is happening on Wednesday?
Oh, the world's ending as we know it. They're turning on the Large Hadron Collider, and we're going to collapse into a black hole.
All right, let's go move on to James's interview. No,
excellent.
Seriously, what is happening with this large... We've talked about this. It's the largest collider that's going to go on. It's for studying particle physics stuff, and it's happening in Europe, and it's huge. And there's been these claims that either strange matter will get produced that will annihilate the planet, or a black hole will form, which will suck everything in. And actually, the scientists are actually hoping that a small black hole will form.
Right, and if so, we're not doomed. The black hole would be small enough and not tame, but it would dissipate. It would evaporate, basically. There's a Hawking radiation.
Right.
Yeah. Would basically evaporate. It wouldn't be a problem.
The math that says there's going to be a small black hole, for that math to work, also
there has to be Hawking radiation
right away.
To evaporate,
right.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that I'm going to make a guarantee to you that if a black hole is formed and consumes the Earth, I will buy you lunch. And that's so Thursday, if a black hole forms and destroys the planet on Wednesday, come to me and I'll buy anybody lunch. No problem.
So they're turning it on. It doesn't mean that they're going to be running experiments. The experiments aren't actually scheduled until end of October, October 21st. They're just turning it on. They're going to start running tests. It's 17 miles long. It's a giant ring. It's a bunch of magnets that accelerate particles really fast. They can run into each other and blow up. And create particles and conditions that we've never seen before in a lab setting.
Uh-huh. And what are some of these experiments that are coming to come out? We're going to know more about, potentially more about black matter, or dark energy. We're going to know a lot more about the world after it comes out. So I'm excited to talk about that in the
future.
About
the universe, and we're also going to be looking at how the universe was created. If the Big Bang theory is correct, this should help emulate conditions that were around at that time.
Well, thank you very much.
Hopefully there won't be too big of a bang. I'm just kidding.
Thank you, Miles and John.
Seriously, though, there's nothing to worry about.
Nothing to worry about. Of course not.
Because if we die, it'll be instant and you won't have
and
to worry about it.
And physicists are getting death threats about this.
Yeah,
this
that's
is,
the bad news.
Seriously, folks, it's
calm
not
down.
Going
right.
to be a problem.
All right. Thank you, Miles and John, for the Geek News. And I want to invite now James Glave, author of Almost Green. It's a wonderful look at, the subtitle kind of helps out here, How I Saved 1/6 of a Billionth of the Planet. James, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So, James, your book is kind of a comical look at trying to be green in our society. You live off in an island in British Columbia with your family and
right.
built a studio for writing. I'm assuming you're a writer because your book is definitely well written.
Thank you.
And you want to make that place a green structure. So it kind of walks us through the experience of doing that. What were some of the things you learned in making a studio like this?
Wow, it always costs more than you think it does. This is the number one, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good question. It's it's a project that just grew to be such an enormous, consuming, you know, massive draw and focus of all of my energy and life force. I tend to be one of these very driven, goal-oriented people. And, you know, we'd always planned to build a little, you know, it's sort of like it doubles as an overnight guest suite for friends and family who come to visit us and want to spend a weekend. And I wanted a quiet space to work and, you know, I work from home and I have small children around the house. And so it became this sort of, you know, enormous sort of font of energy and resources and obsession and research, basically. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, it consumed 2 years of my life, basically. And the book is really about that whole story of how I decided to really sort of just take a big leap and make a bold move, as it were, and along the way learn about how we could be building our buildings far more efficiently than we do.
So you made this as a green structure, which in itself is going to cost a lot more, right?
Well, only at the head end. That's the trick, really, and that's really the big conundrum, the big white elephant of green building. You know, essentially, the stuff is more expensive at the capital cost at the front end, but the whole philosophy and the principle, which has been proven, is basically you end up spending that additional money anyway over the life of the building, over the next 10 or 15 years. The only snag being you still need to come up with that money now. And the financing end of things is just not set up to deal with that, what they call life cycle costing. You know, this building may have cost me a pretty penny right now, but I'm going to be saving that. I'm not going to have to repaint it. It's, you know, the energy requirements of the building are so low. You know, anybody that's looked at that plotted anything like peak oil or energy costs, we know that energy is going to become a constrained resource. And so the whole idea of this building is that it requires very, very little of it to heat itself, to light and so forth. All the fixtures are super efficient. They cost more now. You end up saving that money later.
Okay. So that's the kind of buzz that we hear pressed all the time publicly. You know, we can build structures better. We can build vehicles better. We can make a less of an imprint on society, less of a carbon footprint, if we do these not inhabiting what we do, not stopping how we spend or stopping how we consume, but just changing it to make it more efficient. Is that true?
I think it's an interim phase. Right now, I mean, my personal philosophy is we're not going to shop our way out of this mess. What we can do is we're in this sort of interesting in-between epoch, as it were, where we're aware and we have consciousness about what's happening out there, that we're in overshoot, that, you know, we're simply expending more resources than we have available. We're not ready to completely trash the existing structure and system and globalism and all that. It's just not feasible or even realistic or anything. So what we need to do is we need to start correcting the course. And I think the interim first step for that is, you know, as you suggested, green consumerism. And in the technology world is full of examples of that. I mean, the MacBook Air, for example, with very minimal packaging and, you know, highly recyclable aspects to it. All of those, we really need to be making all of our decisions based on those factors until we sort out the really daunting, you know, bigger picture of, you know, how do we actually shift our value system as a society away from consumption and growth as the measure of prosperity to something else?
Okay, that sounds like a good goal, I think. Now, you live on an island. Do you live off the grid?
No, we don't. Okay. We're definitely on the grid, but we're very fortunate up here in that here in British Columbia, our electricity is very green. We're about 90% green. Due mostly to large legacy hydroelectric projects up in the north.
Right.
We import about 10% of our power, and that 10% is coal. It comes from Alberta and from the northwest.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some the technology. Since this is Geek Speak, we want to talk about a little bit of technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
How efficient, what's the efficient difference between a traditional water-storing water heater and an instant on-demand water heater? Is it a lot better?
It is a lot better. I mean, when you set yourself apart from the normal, when you take a minute to think about it, every one of our homes has a 50-gallon tank that's full of hot water that we're pouring energy into to keep hot 24/7 every single day of the year. So in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, If you want to get up and have a hot shower, that hot water's there for you, baby. But we don't. And, you know, it's really interesting when you think about the alternatives that are available, that this just never really occurred to us as a way to do it. And so we keep on plugging these 40 or 50 gallon hot water tanks, electric or gas, in our homes. I mean, I don't know what the stat is, but yeah. it's responsible for quite a large amount of the home's energy consumption.
So this is one of the things my skepticism brain clicks into. If you had a perfect thermos type of situation where you're not losing expended heat, then all you have to do is heat the water. Then you're doing a fine situation of storing a whole bunch of water. Heat it first, it stays hot. But the problem is that these things leak, and that's really the biggest problem in energy efficiency in the home is the wasted energy that occurs all the time. And some other things you did had to do with your piping. Can you explain a little bit of what you did in the structure with water pipes?
Oh, well, we insulated them inside the walls, so they're covered in foam. But it's the hot water on demand unit that is the most interesting. You're right. You laser right onto that. And it was actually a real challenge to install it. I have a Bosch unit that's electrically fired. Mm-hmm. Most of them are natural gas or propane. I decided I didn't want to burn fossil fuels in the building, so
since most electricity comes from hydro.
Yes,
then
exactly.
You are. Yeah, it's less of a carbon footprint.
It was definitely the greener choice, but you know, it's sort of like it's a very cutting edge technology up here, at least. I couldn't find a plumber who would touch it because it didn't have the right sticker on the box. So I ended up installing it and plumbing it myself. My electrician, fortunately, would hook it up, which was good because it pulls 120 amps every time you turn on a faucet. Basically, it pulls a huge amount of juice very quickly. Only when you need the hot water, but it's still over the course of a year. Like, I don't often take a shower in that space, so you know I'm only occasionally going to need that.
Right.
And so it literally fries the water as it pulls it through a matrix, more than half of my total household current capacity. Yeah.
I think the current numbers you're using are a little off, but we won't get into that. But
okay.
Is it microwave or is it using just heated elements? Do you know?
Just heated elements. Okay. It's like a waffle matrix.
Did you make this structure as a complete living experience? So it does have a kitchen, and what kind of utilities and stuff were interesting in the kitchen, if you have
it? It has a kitchen, a kitchenette. Due to zoning and codes and so forth, in my community, I can't do a complete kitchen in a building because then it counts as a second building, and we're not zoned for that. So you can get away with a kitchenette or, you know, as it says on the building permit, a coffee bar. So I have a small Energy Star fridge in there, and I have a sink that's actually a reclaimed sink we got from a salvage yard that happened to have a ultra low flow faucet on there. So that's basically it. The countertop is made of a material called paper stone, which is recycled paper that's compressed under extreme heat and pressure. And bound with a non-toxic resin.
Now, is that recycled paper? I mean, why not
recycled, 100% post-consumer.
Huh,
yeah.
Okay. That stuff's really bizarre because it's paper, but it can get wet. You can soak it. You can wash it, put it in the dishwasher.
Yeah. Well, it's sealed with a beeswax-based cream, and I just reapply that every 6 months or so, and it works wonderfully. Water beads up right on the top of it, so we haven't had any issues at all with it. So it's a really cool material. They make it in Oregon, I believe.
Great. We are speaking with author James Glave of his newest book. We're talking about his newest book, Almost Green, his experience building a green shed for his home. And if you'd like to ask James some questions, you're welcome to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free anywhere in the U.S., I think in Canada as well, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give it that number again in just a second, too. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Imagine the Marx Brothers answering questions about cars. Picture Monty Python trying to imitate engine sounds. Mix that up with a little Dr. Ruth and some Smothers Brothers, and you've got Car Talk. You can hear Click and Clack give their advice on cars right after Geek Speak. That's a half an hour from now. That's right. Car Talk following Geek Speak here on KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning on Geek Speak are Ben Jaffe, John Tracy, and Miles Elam. We're speaking with author James Glave about his book, Almost Green, his experience in producing a green living space for his family in British Columbia. Well, Ben Jaffe, welcome to Geek Speak.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in. I'm sorry that I told you so late. We had a little bit of changes today on Geek Speak. I want to make some announcements. First off, we are still working on trying to get Buzz Aldrin to be on our program. And the other announcement I wanted to make is about some local events. Some local events that are happening here in the Santa Cruz County area. First, the Linux Installers Fest in Felton is happening. That's September 6th today from 2 to 6 p.m. at Felton Fire Station. That's 131 Kirby Street in Felton. And basically, you can go there and learn about Linux, and they'll actually, if you bring a computer, they'll actually help you install the software. There's much more information about the Linux Installer Fest and the group that runs that from geekspeak.org. You can get to that. And also, Santa Cruz Go Green. Santa Cruz area residents and businesses are inviting to drop off and recycle their old unwanted electronics and computer equipment. The drive is part of the Volt's company-wide Go Green initiative to encourage environmentally responsible business practices among its employees and business partners. It is happening September 19th from 10 to 4, and the location is at 2425 Porter Street, Suite 11, that's in the rear, in Soquel. You can learn more information about the phone number to call and everything by going to GeekSpeak's website. And today's show, of course, is September 6th. And basically, they will take old parts and try to reuse them, which is a wonderful way. Reuse of computer and electronic technology in general, reusing is a lot better than trying to recycle it. So let's go back on to James Glave. Oh, and if you'd like to call, please feel free to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, the toll free number is 1-800-655-5877.
So, James, I had a question for you. I wanted to know what type of what you've learned from building the shed that you feel you could bring into your everyday life. And if you were building a new, you know, typical house, what things could you learn from the shed that you could bring into the new construction?
Well, that's a really great question. I think certainly insulation and the building envelope, but as well the building orientation are the really big ones. You know, when my house was built, it's sort of a spec home. I chose design A, B, or C, and I had the builder pour the slab in the front yard that we would eventually turn into the eco shed. You know, I was living 3,000 miles away at the time. I didn't really know the orientation of the site. You know, as it turns out, it completely ignores the sun. There's almost no glass on the south side of my house. The view is in the other direction, so that's where all the windows are. And so as a result, I really can't take advantage of any of the solar gain that naturally you would be able to have. I mean, we even turn on the lights earlier in the winter than we need to because we just don't get any sunshine. So I think in terms of just being aware of how the sun as a free source of energy can be used to your advantage is a huge one that really doesn't cost anything more in terms of building.
Let me ask you a question. Yeah. Then. The Central Coast of California has a lot of large trees. Yeah. And a lot of homes are shaded from the trees, which is good for summer.
Shaded by the trees.
Shaded by the trees. But some people feel that taking down trees to get more sunlight in is effective use of lighting and everything. What do you think about that? That decision whether removing a large tree or not is the best thing. I mean, do you want to leave your lights on more, or do you want to use more heating, or should you cut the tree down? How do you make that decision?
I mean, I think it's wildly dependent on the site and the conditions and the amount of exposure that you would gain and so forth. And the other thing to consider is that a lot of trees are deciduous. They lose their leaves in winter, and that's exactly when you want to welcome a lot more sunshine in. So there's certainly homes in that situation here on our island. We live in a West Coast temperate rainforest as well, and there's a lot of alders. The alders all drop their leaves. The sun comes in through the branches. So I don't think it has to be an either-or situation. Mm-hmm. I certainly wouldn't take down a giant redwood to bring a little sun into my kitchen. I think that's pretty much impossible to defend. So,
that's because you don't have houses that are being ripped up by the roots of redwood trees. But in any case, that's a Santa Cruz Mountains problem more than anything
else. All right. Yeah, fair enough. There's one other technology I wanted to mention, though, since you are geek speak. If I were building a new home, I would consider a heat recovery ventilator. Excuse me. And this is a device that ventilates the home. Interior air quality and molds in winter is a huge issue. As we're sealing our homes more and more tightly,
right,
to keep the heat inside. But as a result of that, we're not getting as much fresh air circulating inside our homes, and that's leading to issues of mold and so forth. The wonderful little technology, it's been very popular in Europe for a long time, a device called a heat recovery ventilator constantly brings in fresh outside air. But what it does is it salvages the heat from the outgoing air. It passes the two streams of air, never touch each other, but pass through a kind of a matrix
setup. That's so smart.
And it salvages up to 70% of the warmth that's already in the building with using that, you know, as it draws the fresh air in. So the air is pre-warmed by the outgoing air.
That's a great idea. I mean, I never really thought
of it. It's
not
very expensive.
Yeah. It's a heat exchanger.
It's a heat exchanger. It's a couple of grand installed, basically, for a large home.
It does make sense, because if you ever have an expert come into your home to do a retrofit to try to save energy, the first thing they're going to do is try to seal every single crack possible.
That's right.
And, of course, you've got no more fresh air after that.
So that's right.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. Well, let's go ahead and take a call. We're going to go to Santa Cruz. Eric, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello?
Hi, Eric. What's your question today?
First of all, I want to say that I have never heard of these environmentalists calling large hydro green. Pretty much universally agreed that large hydro is very environmentally destructive and not green.
It is very environmentally destructive of the site. And after that initial destruction of a whole bunch of trees and shrubs and everything that will pull carbon out of the air, after that, it is a carbon neutral energy source, which is really quite impressive. There aren't very many. I mean, you've got solar, you've got wind, and both of those also have some effect. In any case, what's your question?
Well, you know, there are ongoing issues with large hydro, you know, damage to the riparian corridors and wildlife.
So yeah.
But anyway, I think that what you said about the hot water heating being a thermos is entirely right on. And your guests didn't even know the statistics, but they estimate that there's about a 10% saving over an efficient tank storage water heater. And I think those are national statistics. So in Santa Cruz, which has a very mild climate, I think the savings are even less. And then since your guest is using electric rather than gas, electric is much, much less efficient than gas. So I would bet that he's probably... maybe for his studio, which he says he doesn't use the shower efficient, but for a regular household hot water heater in Santa Cruz, I don't think it makes any. I have never, with a well-insulated water heater in my own home, I have never, ever had the hot water heater fire after I've used hot water. So I think what you talked about in the thermos effect is really accurate. And really needs to be site-specific.
No, I agree, Eric. I agree. That's why I actually kind of brought it up, is that in a perfect thermos situation of a water storage, there is no wasted heat. You heat the water, it gets to a certain temperature, it stays that way forever. The thing is, there is inefficiencies in the design, and they're normally put outside the home, especially if they're gas. But additionally, what James brought up, which I never really thought about before, is that because he's in an environment where he gets most of all his electricity from non-carbon footprint source, him burning gas to light his water heater is a carbon footprint. And so it's nice that he's able to be in a space that he's not. And I'm curious, like, how bad is it going to be for us to have hot water heaters that burn natural gas as gas prices go up, but also as we realize more and more that we should try to do everything we can not to burn carbon fuel sources?
Right.
But
did you have one more? I brought up the part about large hydro, because you made a point that once it's done, it's done. But
once it destroys the environment,
They've actually, there's real severe effects. I mean, we're going through that now. It's not really hydroelectric issues, but it's more water irrigation issues in California with the Bay Delta. And, what they want to do is they want to stop diverting so much water to irrigation issues. So I don't think that large hydro, once it's built, it's done and there's no environmental effect. There's still huge environmental effects. And I'm not an expert ecologist, but I think if you did poll experts, they would almost universally condemn large hydro, including large hydro that's already built. And that's not to say we should tear them all down, but I don't think that's really...
Well, Eric, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call. Yeah,
can I just offer a comment on that, Lyle?
Yes, please do, James.
You're completely right. I mean, there's nothing green about flooding large valleys and riparian areas. And I just... All I want to say on to that is that we're in this, again, we're in this in-between time where we really don't have a perfect solution, and all we can really do is follow our gut to guide us to find the least bad solution. Up here right now in BC, there's tremendous debate and controversy over the power utility is hoping or is expecting to farm out contracts for quite a few run-of-river projects. We've got thousands of miles of undeveloped coastline up here that are just full of rivers that rush year-round. People want to put in small run-of-river projects that would divert the water out of the river, run it through turbines and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very in favor of those because even though there is an impact in terms of putting in roads and transmission lines, you know, we're talking about a carbon neutral fuel source once it's installed. We simply have to move our grid entirely off fossil fuels. We don't have any, you know, it's either cutting down a few trees and putting in a hydro electric line. And I'm not saying there's no footprint of that, but the footprint of torching the planet by continuing to burn fossil fuels is not an acceptable alternative. So,
and just to clarify on what those are, is it's not building a dam to create hydro.
Right.
It's pulling the water out of the river, running it through a turbine, and then putting it right back in the river.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with all of the different, with all energy sources, it's always a trade-off of good versus bad or efficiency versus environmental degradation. So, I mean, they all have negatives, but some are more extreme than others in terms of that.
I think the future is a mix. It's going to have to be a mix of renewable mm-hmm. sources. Some of them, you know, like you said, having serious imprints, different kinds of footprints than others. Solar panel production creates an enormous amount of waste, but it's inevitable. It's something we have to do right now.
And
so,
also at this point, you need fossil fuels to get up that hot to create the solar panels.
That's right.
So,
well, let's go to our next call. Rupert, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Bryson, Hesperia, which uh-huh. is right in southern Monterey County, right on the San Luis Obispo border.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, what's your question?
It was a point, actually, which, since I called, as you guys are mostly covered, and that is that the creation of energy by any source, I would suggest, creates pollution. And since I called, you've already covered the fact that while your guest today was pleased to use electricity that came from hydroelectric plants, they obviously have greatly gone out of fashion recently, and they cause pollution. It was just alluded to that the creation of PV solar panels, which have high silicon content and take a lot of energy to produce. And that, by the way, for your listeners, is called embodied energy in the solar field. That's the energy that is used to create something, which in
right.
turn itself creates energy. Panels, even in a place where you have a lot of sun, as we do in the central coast, takes between 3 and 5 years to pay off until you get back to a neutral point.
Yeah.
So my point, I guess, is that while fossil fuels and carbon footprint is an important way to look at things, it's primarily important because that's how most of our energy comes. In fact, as I said, the use of all energy creates pollution, and we need to think about ways to reduce our energy footprint.
All right.
The guy who spends $100,000 and carpets his roof with solar panels is not really doing any of us a favor in terms of green use.
All right.
The favor is reducing our consumption.
Thank you mm-hmm. very much for the call, Rupert.
You're welcome.
Yeah, bye. Addressing the problem instead of addressing the symptom.
Yeah, exactly. James, you want to address that a little bit?
Yeah, again, it gets back to that thing about completely reinventing our society. It's a little daunting to put on your to-do list on your iCal window there. You know, I think ultimately this question comes up again and again. You're still shopping, you're still expanding, you're still consuming. There wasn't something in my front yard, and now I put something there, and I used a lot of resources to do so.
Right.
And you know, while there are other arguments, I mean, for example, I use that as a workspace rather than commuting to the city, you know, and that is in itself a green attribute. You know, there's really no answer to that except it's going to take a while for our civilization to evolve and to reassess basically how we've been doing things, which is that consumption and expansion is a prerequisite. Growth is a prerequisite for prosperity and quality of life. And, you know, we're not there yet. We're not even close to being there yet. And so we've just got to do the best we can given the current framework that we're all operating inside of. I don't think dropping out of society is a legitimate solution right now. And I like to think of myself as basically, through doing this project, through learning this, through writing this book, through telling people about some of the things that we've learned, we're helping to steer that ship in a better direction.
Something I'm wondering about is, we've already talked about how to save energy, save electricity, reducing our carbon footprint that way. But I also wonder about something we haven't covered, at least to my knowledge, was the idea of you have a hot water heater to make sure that you have the flow limiters on the shower heads. Mm-hmm. Things like that really don't change your quality of life, but they affect the volume of water that you're using to begin with, not just a resource of electricity or how to get energy, but also fresh water, potable water.
Right. And of course, not just how much water you use, but also the temperature you use it at. If you can take a colder shower, if you can turn your water heater down, that's also a saving.
But that is something else that I wonder about is, should we be using hot water heaters? What about the newer technology that doesn't have a tank of water that you keep that is actually an on-demand
heating?
Well,
that's what we've been talking about
today. Oh,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I've got here.
Yeah, and there's a good debate about which is which, but go on, James.
I was just going to also mention the other piece that plugs into that we need to consider is solar thermal systems on the roof, which is not as expensive or resource intensive as PV solar, right, photovoltaics.
And that's basically a black water storage or water filter system on the roof. Sun heats it up, you pump the water through it, and it heats the water up.
That's
pretty efficient.
Right.
You're not going to electricity or anything.
And the more efficient version of that is uses an evacuated tube, and it's essentially it keeps the water in a sort of a long spherical cylinder, and that is able to realize far more efficiencies in terms of collecting sun, just because of any angle that the sun's in the sky, it's still going to be heating that water. And if it's in a vacuum as well, obviously think of the metaphor of the thermos. That's a far more efficient way of doing it. So there's no reason. In fact, in California, the governor has put forth a real strong agenda to get these as common as anything. That's a really wonderful way to make a big difference right there.
I want to talk to you about your experience getting a gifted vehicle for your family.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other narrative of the book, and that is my father-in-law. We call him Padre. He's sort of benefactor, as you will. He's at a very different point in his sort of evolution of green. He has a very different worldview. He's a hardcore Republican. He thinks global warming is a liberal conspiracy, a swindle. He lives a very different lifestyle than ours. And so this is one of the themes of the book, is sort of the emotional entanglements of the carbon, of the high octane era, if you will. He gave us an SUV a few years ago when our car was just about to die. And we were like, well, how can you possibly turn that down? Isn't that the greatest, most generous present ever? He gave us a very nice one. It's a Lexus RX 300, premium edition, nice sound system and all that. As I began my green evolution and began to work on this project, it became the white elephant in the room. He also, by the way, I should mention, bought us a carport. He had our builder build us a carport to park his SUV in. Both of those items have now been removed from our life. Not without fallout, I might add. We did, the subtitle of the book in Canada is slightly different, and it says in part how I ditched my SUV. And that was, the SUV becomes a character, becomes this cross, this, oh my God, if I get rid of this, do I also destroy my relationship with my father-in-law?
Right.
And negotiating all that stuff, the social politics of green are just an area that absolutely fascinates me. So,
yeah, but wouldn't it have been much easier to say I got rid of the SUV not because of some environmental reason, but just because gas prices are so high?
That's how I did frame it to him.
Okay, yeah.
But I think he was still a little wounded. But
yeah,
I just put it as, it costs us $75 to fill the tank now. Gas in Canada is already basically $4 a gallon or more, mm-hmm. has been for
more.
A long time. So, it was certainly pulling us down hard. And and that was really how I framed it. And I said, I don't think it's an economical solution for us right now. I said, speaking his language. Maybe he's even listening right now. Hi, Padre. Mm-hmm. So, we've all got to sort of negotiate all these interfaces and connections that we have.
That's one of the things I really appreciate your book. It's funny, and I like funny. Most people do. And it's really about the struggles that we are all facing on what we decide to do and how we decide to do it. You know, can you really accept taking that paper cup at the restaurant? Why don't you just bring a cup with you all the time? These decisions that you can do to help make you feel better, does it really have an impact? Is it a way of training yourself or your kids for future better society? In any case, the author, James Glave, we have on the phone right now. His book is Almost Green: How I Saved one sixth of a billionth of the planet.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but as you can see, a really interesting read. In any case, we have Hal from Santa Cruz on. Hal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning. I built my first passive solar house 32 years ago here in Santa Cruz, and have been focused on this for a long time. The house I'm in now, I bought, was already built, and it had a active hot water heater, solar hot water heater. And I was confronted with that problem discussed earlier about, you know, the waste of it heating all the time, because I was only showering in the morning. And for $35 down at Orchard Supply, I bought a time clock. And so that hot water heater only comes on from 4:30 or 5 o'clock for about 45 minutes every day.
Oh, well, so this is interesting. And so does the water get cold during the day?
Well, in half of the year, I turn off the backup heater anyway, because mm-hmm. the solar hot water heater heats it enough.
Right.
So the backup heater, which is electric, contrary to Eric's comment earlier, electric is actually more efficient. You lose efficiency if your electricity is coming from Moss Landing or from the grid. There's about 8 or 9% transmission loss, and the power plants are only about 40% efficient that are burning fossil fuels. But I have 2,500 watts of photovoltaic on my roof, mm-hmm. so my house is basically electricity neutral.
Right. My point is that there
are smart technologies that are very cheap.
Well,
that's right.
Okay, so I agree there are. And the thing that would concern me a bit about this, Hal, is that if you allow the water temperature to decrease over time versus keeping the temperature at a steady temperature, you actually might have more loss.
Yeah, but you're not taking into account that even in the winter, I get some heating during the day from the solar hot water heater backing it up.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the idea, just the aspect of allowing water to heat up and then allowing it to cool off and heat up again. The most efficient thing to do is to get it extremely well insulated so it does not lose its heat.
Yeah, I bought the high efficiency tank. And
nice.
I put a couple extra layers of insulation around the outside.
Nice.
I've already done
That's great.
You know, all of that, and then it's in a closet outside, and I put reflective foil on all the surfaces inside that closet.
It sounds like you need to do tours of how to build a house in this area.
Come on up here and help me with my installation, will you?
So, and then the other issue, he talked about insulating his pipes, but you want to have all your piping very close to your hot water heater mm-hmm. because it takes a long time to replace all the water in a pipe, even a 3/8-inch diameter pipe. And so if you have sinks or other things in other parts of your house, you might want a local flash peak or demand water heater, which I have under my kitchen sink, to create the hot water there, because it's about, probably 35 feet of run.
Right, and of course that pipe, as it doesn't get used, is going to decrease in temperature, and it's a source of loss. Water included, because if you need hot water and you have to wait for all that water to run down, you're wasting quite a bit. You know, there's other efficiencies that you don't see as much, and thank you very much, Hal, for the call.
Yep.
Thanks. And the other efficiency I was wondering about, you must know a bit about this, James. What about other models of making the house more efficient? Like, why don't we have a better use of gray water?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because there's terror and fear of litigation that some recycled water is going to end up in the potable stream, and or it's going to go onto plants in your garden that you're going to eat, and there was something in there. It's fear, basically, there's absolutely no reason that we shouldn't be salvaging all of our gray water and reusing it. It's illegal up here. You have to do it on the sly, basically, and there's a lot of people who do. We have water storage issues in the summertime. It rains here, pours every single day all winter, but we don't have the capacity to store it. So a lot of people do use gray water just casually, and you know, but when you're actually plumbing it in, it's a whole other scale, basically. But especially in desert climates like California, it's New Mexico where we used to live, we did that as well a lot. So
I think Miles, did you have a point? Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking you're absolutely right. I'm thinking about the second rinse on a washer, the amount of water that's just going in. It's such a minimal amount that if you use that for flushing a toilet, that's...
Well, this comes down to my, society at large protecting every individual thing, where if you set up a structure in a situation where you cannot get hurt, you know, because of the legal systems, the structures around, you can't get hurt, people stop thinking about their own safety. And here's an example. The water is a perfect example of that. We have rules and regulations in this country as well about not using gray water. And gray water is basically water that comes out of your plumbing system, which is not from your toilet. So the idea behind it is it's not clean. You don't want to use it for drinking or anything, but it's also perfectly fine water for a lot of tasks that you use water all the time. Watering the lawn is a perfect example of that. And so the idea is that we have regulations so that there's no danger of someone accidentally drinking gray water out of the hose, so it's safely. But that makes people not think about the potential gains of using that water. And so it's one of those situations where I wish that you could get certified or something to put one of these gray water systems in your house, and then the local rules are like, it's okay because there's somebody there that's going to think about it and be smart. In any case, James, I've enjoyed your book, Almost Green, and I really appreciate you being on Geek Speak. Was there any closing thoughts you wanted to give to us?
Yeah, only that I would just say that technology is as much a part of the problem as a solution. When I think about digital audio, digital photography, that the savings in terms of chemicals, in terms of plastic waste that have been realized there are just tremendous. Teleconferencing is taking people off airplanes. The second half of that is the life cycle, the end use of the cycle. I think that we need to really address e-waste in a very serious way, instead of just shipping it out of the picture, out of sight, out of mind. So just in terms of the tech and the geek focus of the show, that's something I'd like to leave your listeners with to think about.
Thank you very much, James.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. James Glave is the author of Almost Green. You can learn more about everything we've talked about on our website, geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak on KOSP is also supported by, comes from Barogo Solar. Oh, cool. Offering photovoltaic solutions to enable homes and businesses to be green and resource savvy with sharp solar panels. Boring has 28 years of experience and a local team ready to help. Information at BORREGOSOLAR. Oh, I see. BORREGOSOLAR.com. Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Otto. Streaming live and podcasting at KOSP.org. This is Geek Speak. The geeks this today were Ben Jaffe, John Tracy, and Miles Elam. Thanks, geeks.
You're welcome.
Glad to be here.
My name's Lyle Troxel. Answering the phone, as he is every week, is Rick Philman. Thank you so much, Rick, for doing that. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Today with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Families with autistic kids have a number of people and places they call upon for support. But finding the right care isn't easy. How do parents get the help their autistic children need? An autism advocate has some advice for parents navigating the often complicated care system. Hear about it when Day to Day brings you the first part of a special series on autism, Monday on Day to Day at noon here on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxel. I'll see you next week here on the station.